ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and the third program in our Radio National summer season of highlights from the past 12 months. Now, I'm going to begin by telling you that this interview you're about to hear was meant to go out on the show a week earlier than it did. We made a studio booking at the ABC for the guest, but the guest was flying in from out of the city and her flight was delayed, which meant we had to reschedule the interview for the following week. It was really no problem, and I'll concede that that was probably not the most thrilling anecdote you've ever heard. But the thing is, this week we're talking about time and how in a colonised country like Australia, a certain understanding of time, a certain kind of control and regulation of time holds sway in ways that you might not have considered. The ABC, God bless it, is one of those institutions that run on very strict linear schedules. And if you want your story to be told on the ABC, you've got to be on time. You've got to get on the clock. You've got to get to the studio when the booking has been made. That's how the whole system works, and there's really no alternative. And of course, that's fine. I mean, that conformity to linear time is part of what helps society to function. You can't just opt out of it. But today we're talking about how linear time can be put to the service of colonialist ends and a certain understanding of the state that marginalises not just Indigenous temporalities, but Indigenous people and communities. My guest is Bronte Gosper. She's a Wiradjuri woman from the town of Orange in New South Wales. She recently completed her Master's in Oral History at Columbia University in New York. And as part of that degree, she made a documentary recording the histories and stories of Aboriginal activists in Australia. Earlier this year, Bronte gave a talk about Indigenous temporalities at the Sydney Observatory as part of the Powerhouse Museum's On Time series that explored various philosophies of time. And I caught up with Bronte Gosper in our ABC Sydney studio. So, Wiradjuri woman, originally from Orange, came to be living in Manhattan doing this oral history master's at Columbia University, working on a documentary recording the histories of Indigenous activism in Australia. That's a hell of a mix of environments and activities. And I imagine that would have been really interesting just in terms of how you presented and talked about your work to people in the US, but also in terms of how the experience maybe shaped or at least affected your own identity as an Indigenous Australian woman. Can you tell me a bit about that experience?
Yeah, it was really interesting, quite challenging at times, definitely a lot of explaining to do, which can be quite tiring when you're not around other Indigenous Australians. But I think in a sense it was also quite unique and freeing. Like, New York obviously has very much higher minority populations than Australia, and the US in general has places where whiteness is not the majority, like DC is a majority black city. So you kind of see these spaces where whiteness is not so overwhelming, and you kind of get hope for, I guess, Indigenous futures and ways of making space for those stories. So coming back was a bit depressing in that sense, but, you know, the US also has a whole host of other issues. So I think, probably what it did do was reaffirm this idea that Australia kind of treats Indigenous issues as symbolic rather than material. And it kind of made me, I guess, more aware of that, just being in a different place, and not necessarily even the US, just being outside of Australia and all the pressure that comes within that to perform a certain kind of identity as an Indigenous person.
Did you get the sense that in the States that these issues around, you know, race or racialized minorities are less symbolic, more material, or, you know, more sort of in people's faces, if you like?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. It's hard. I mean, there's a lot of symbolism there as well. And even,
sure,
like, I mean, right now it's pretty dire place to be if you're a minority of any kind. But I think mostly it was just being around other Indigenous and Black people who had carved out spaces where there was kind of this extensive work that you could do that wasn't always in conversation with a white audience. I think that was the interesting part of it, or the freeing part of it. But, you know, when it does come into conversation with the government or with those bodies, institutions, yeah, I think the same issues probably remain.
Well, let's talk about this a little bit, about this documentary work that you were doing. And the problem that you mentioned in your master's thesis, which is you describe it as the constant tension of recording Indigenous stories as an Indigenous scholar. Tell me about that. What was that tension?
Yeah, I think it's this idea that Indigenous identity gets flattened into something that's always meant to mean something for the audience. Like, I suppose, like, stereotypes and things come into it. And I just found, like, if I was telling people that I was doing a story about Indigenous Australians, the response was kind of like, oh, it's so hard, or it's so much, like, the expectation of suffering, I suppose. And then having to be, like, as an Indigenous scholar, as someone who's, like, in that world, also having to present it to an audience that knows nothing about it. It's like subject and explainer. So it's kind of trying to make these stories legible to people, but also feeling a lot of pressure. You know, like, I never want to be a sole voice on anything, or coming across as thinking that I have the right answer to being Indigenous. And I think a lot of Indigenous people feel that tension, and that's a result of, like, a colonial pressure that Indigenous identity is this, like, monolith. And, you know, we all think the same thing. So I think that was kind of the hard thing for me.
Yeah, a lot of this, of course, has to do with testimony. And you have some really interesting things to say about Indigenous testimony, one of which being that, exactly as you say, this expectation that, well, first of all, that testimony will constitute some sort of activism forever and always, but also that testimony fulfills this function that has to do with stories of suffering. How did you deal with that expectation in making your documentary? Did it affect your approach in some sort of explicit, conscious way?
Well, I mean, my whole thesis was trying to unpack what happens to testimonies, particularly Indigenous testimonies, once they're, like, loose in the polity, like, which I think we see it all the time, of Indigenous testimony is framed by the state as this moment of national reckoning. Like, when people talk about the Bringing Them Home report, which was obviously the report that compiled all of the Stolen Generations stories, it was kind of this thing that, like, okay, now we've recorded this testimony, we've listened, and we've found a way to contain that grief and now move on. So I think Indigenous testimony always kind of gets resolved and turned into, like, something that the state can say, we did that and now it's over. And then as a result, there's no, like, monetary compensation or structural change. It's more just like, we've listened and now it's over. And I think, you know, obviously the idea that listening is healing is true, like, in a lot of senses, and personal therapy, I suppose. But from a state perspective, I think the approach should be far more than listening, and it should be urgent action. So I suppose I was interested in my documentary in resisting that it's something that's over. So testimonies are continuing, and it's disrupting this idea that these things that have happened live in the past. Like, it kind of makes a demand on the present, I suppose, and doesn't allow the book to be closed and a minister to stand up and say, isn't this great? We've done it. Reconciliation has been achieved. But instead, kind of, yeah, an ongoing responsibility to actually make change.
Yeah, there's something interesting about that process that sort of erases the present. You know, if you have this sort of process of listening, I think you call it the performance of symbolic listening. So injustice gets relegated to the past. All the good things are going to happen in the future.
Yeah.
But the present, where everything is very much happening, sort of disappears in a funny way.
Yeah, totally. Two of the people that talk about that a lot is Elizabeth Strakosch and Alyssa McCoon. And they talk about this idea that, like, the settler claim to the future And this Indigenous future is always about to happen, like not yet, not yet. And really, I think that's something that's representative of not just Indigenous affairs. I think you see that in almost every facet of the major issues in Australia right now. Like, it's a fundamental inability to relate to time. Like, we don't think about the long term. It's kind of like this short-termism, I guess. And it's really pronounced in Indigenous affairs, where we have, like, with every new minister, it's like, okay, everything's new and now we've got a new, like, programs have to come and go and communities have to prove their need again and again. It's like time kind of resets with every new election cycle or every new minister. I think that's kind of something that is what's important about thinking about Indigenous temporality and at the same time how temporality is constructed by, like, a settler colonial society. And it's this idea that you can avoid confronting the political demands that Indigenous people make today, in this moment, in the present, by thinking of this future as almost this fantasy rather than a responsibility. And that's why these, like, slogan, these protest slogans, like "still here" or "always was," like protest slogans that invoke temporality, tend to be the most, like, disrupting slogans, because they're disrupting this idea that the future is inevitably settler. But it's a very powerful political payoff, because the future never arrives.
There's a certain calculation about this too, isn't there? Because when we talk about Indigenous Australian history generally and colonisation, the focus is almost always on land, you know, the possession and control of land. But your interest in the concept of time also has this sense of possession and control, which is really interesting, because the typical Western concept of time is that nobody possesses or controls it. You know, time is just something that we all exist within. It's like this relentless universal force that sort of sweeps us all along. So it's interesting to me that you talk about it in terms of possession and control. Tell me some more about that. I mean, about that possession and control of time within a settler colonial context.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we are familiar with the idea that there is possession of land, but I guess the idea is that there's also a possession of thought and the systems that we use to think through how we live. And one of the most important things, in my opinion, is time. Like, it's an imposition of a timeline, but also, like, clock time. But, like, the timeline of, you know, when history started, when things end, when healing ends, and when we've come a long way or when we're not there yet, and justice is kind of becomes swept up in that. And I think it's, yeah, a big part of how power functions in Australia. I mean, in other parts of the world as well. But, yeah, it's this, I guess, Western imposition and idea of time that's kind of this move towards this future that'll kind of never really manifest. And it allows you to engage with capitalism and to say that if I just keep doing this and I just keep on going, then eventually it'll be great, which of course causes a lot of people to end up feeling really depressed. So I guess that's why I think these ideas that are often siphoned as, like, oh, it's an Indigenous idea and it's something separate from other sectors of humanity's ideas. I think it shouldn't be that way. I think it should be something that can inform everyone. And I mean, the ancient Greeks used to talk about time. You know, like, Heraclitus had this idea of flux and that time was not this super linear thing. And I think it's a fundamentally human thing to not engage in this, like, linear colonial sense of time. And I think Indigenous ways of thinking hold kind of a key to that way of thinking that I think could inform a lot of how we think about the world, and particularly in Australia, where, like, they're always talking about how we have this, like, wealth of resources and so many opportunities to be having these really sustainable ways of living, and yet our biggest industries are, you know, mining, and which are the most, like, short-term focused and unaware of time things. Like, there's no consideration of the future or the past, importantly, as well.
On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, this is The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and my guest this week, Bronte Gosper, who's a filmmaker, screenwriter, Wiradjuri woman, originally from Orange in New South Wales. And earlier this year, Bronte spoke at the Sydney Observatory as part of On Time, which was a four-part series of talks scattered throughout 2025 and run by the Sydney Powerhouse Museum. More information on The Philosopher's Zone website. I'd like to talk a bit about Indigenous temporalities, and I'm not sure whether to put that term in sort of quote marks or not, because I guess when we talk about Indigenous temporalities, we're talking about a range of different cultures and traditions, yes, and understandings, but let's just park that for the moment. You've written that these temporalities pay attention to time rather than trying to control it. Mm. How does this play into the everywhen? Tell me about the everywhen, a really interesting concept.
Yeah, the everyone, I think, was a concept that W.E.H. Stanner talked about to try and describe what he thought the temporal logic of the dreaming was. And he was a settler, so of course it's, you know, it is his projection onto that and whatever that contained. But it was a suggestion that time is not linear, but layered. So past, present, and future can inform each other. And I guess how I think about that, there's a lot of Indigenous scholars that have theorized very different understandings of time. And like Tyson Yunker Porter is one person who talks a lot about this and would have a lot more to say about the real nitty-gritty of that stuff. But I think the way it's helpful for me to talk about is just this idea that like how Western society often perceives the dreaming is that it's this kind of outside time thing, or it's, I guess, compared to creation stories. But the dreaming is really just stories that help you understand the present and the future and things that generate obligation to the world around you, which I guess is this idea of the everyone. Like as you're moving through the world, you're considering the past and the future. It's something that is and was and will be, and something that you're like always in relation to. So, you know, I think there's often this like romanticizing of Indigenous temporalities where it's like, you know, I think, I mean, there's a romanticizing of every kind of Indigenous ontology where the meaning becomes a bit reified and far away from what actually is very practical knowledge about the land and the world around you that informs basic understandings of how to live and how to continue life so that you don't destroy the world around you, rather than this kind of mystical thing.
It's interesting that you bring it up in the context of the dreaming, because I've always had this problem with the dreaming. I mean, just the term itself, in that from that settler perspective, you know, dreaming is what you do when you're asleep.
Yeah.
You've sort of taken time out from the world of productivity and achievement and all those things.
Yeah.
And I also think of Freud, you know, who believed that dreams are the domain of the unconscious, but he also thought that repressing the unconscious is what we have to do in order to have civilization. Mm. And I think that's a really interesting idea to bring to this discussion of settler colonial temporality, because there's a sense, if you sort of go with that, that Indigenous temporality is not just sort of time out from civilization. It's actually sort of positioned against civilization. It's what, yes, civilization has to repress to simply exist.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I often think about the fact that I think dreaming is probably a pretty bad like translation of what that actually is. Like it's more like an awakening, to be honest. Like it's much more of like a paying attention to than it is like a state of unconscious sleep. And I think you're right, like there's this idea that being civilized is the inevitable future. Civilized, I'm putting in quotation marks. And yeah, I think it does kind of relegate any way of what people imagine to be Indigenous, which also is kind of like an awareness to nature and the world around you, as, yeah, something that has to be repressed and controlled.
The power dynamic, though, I mean, goes the other way, doesn't it? And you've written about how refusing colonial time comes to be a way of asserting Indigenous sovereignty. What does this mean in practice? Like, what are some of the ways in which one can enact that refusal of colonial time?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. but I think by talking about it and questioning and not like disengaging, I guess that's kind of where that idea of turning away from the world comes into play. Like, it's not a disengagement, but it's like refusing to accept the terms that you're being offered and refusing to keep playing inside a system that only understands value in like symbolic or short-term or metaphorical terms. And it is a way of asserting sovereignty to kind of go against that. I mean, so many of the Indigenous activists right now are doing this, but I think the government has to play a role in that. And I guess we're just coming out of this election where there was kind of no real mention of, quote, Indigenous affairs. And I think that's the big mistake, is seeing Indigenous affairs as something that is not completely tied in with every other issue that we have. And paying attention to time and how we relate to the future and whether we're willing to be accountable to people that we'll never meet is a very human idea. And it's very practical as well, like the housing market. Like, these are things that deeply affect Indigenous people around the country. And these are things that I think are presented as separate to Indigenous issues. And it's almost like Indigenous issues are just, oh, we want to say that the past, I think this is how it's presented, not by Indigenous people, but, you know, we want to work on or address what happened in the past, but it's happening in the present. Like, there's these things that are happening right now that don't feature in this discussion.
But you mentioned this idea of turning away from the world there. This is the Black American critical theorist Tyrone Palmer, his notion of turning away from the world. And there's something in that phrase that suggests something that is apolitical, you know, turning away from the world, being a sort of a abandoning, you know, activism, resistance. There's also that sort of mean voice that I have in my head purely because I spend too much time reading mean people's tweets on Twitter. But, you know, there's this certain really mean-spirited response to Indigenous demands that goes along the lines of, oh, you want to turn away from the world? Fine, see ya. You want to abandon colonial temporality? Great. Enjoy missing your job interview next week.
Yes,
you know,
totally.
This kind of thing.
Yeah.
So there's a mean way of putting it, but also I think a more generous way of putting it, which is, you know, what about politics? What about activism? Can you turn away from the world and maintain that kind of engagement with the world?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, Tyrone Palmer's whole thing is that he, when he writes about the world, he's doing like a capital W situation. So it's kind of like the world as it exists now is what he's suggesting we turn away from. At least that's how I've interpreted what he talks about. But I think it's turning away from, yeah, what is currently the situation and turning towards something else. And I think what happens a lot, and maybe what I'm talking about is also doing that, but I think it's quite practical concerns. Like, I don't think we need to, you know, all throw our phones in the bin and like pretend that we don't know what time it is, but it's more just like totally changing how we think about the past and the present and the future, which of course is a big task. But I think in small ways, like looking at how things are functioning right now, where we're very focused on short-term, like fossil fuels, like we're mining fossil fuels and we know it's not sustainable. We're not paying attention to time in that sense. And we're having this kind of short-sightedness. And I think it's just like noticing that and reorienting it and demanding that from governments, that they reorient how they're thinking about time. There's probably a better way to say that, but I think when it gets presented as it's an Indigenous concept that's totally separate and doesn't apply to non-Indigenous people, I think that's a wrong characterization. I think it would benefit all of society if some of the ideas that we can glean from Indigenous temporalities were practically used.
Well, really, really interesting talking with you about all this, Bronte. And I just wanted to finish by asking you about the documentary. Is it going out into the world? Will people be able to see it at some point in the not too distant future?
It definitely will be in the world. Don't know when, but soon. Every time I go back to Ardialoon, there's more stuff that we add into the documentary, and it just kind of keeps taking on new lives. But if it has premiered, I've premiered a version of it in New York just before I left, and that's available online. I can send you that link.
Oh, yeah. We'll put that on the website. That'd be great.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. But yeah, I'm trying to kind of now do a lot of what I've been talking about in scripted writing. Like now I'm writing films and TV, and I guess that's a world where you can kind of imagine a different reality, and I think that can be quite powerful. So that's kind of what I'm quite focused on right now.
What's the nature of the TV work? Is that more documentary? Is it drama?
I'm writing a lot of stories about growing up in Orange, and, you know, I guess I want to write characters who are Indigenous and who are like complicated and sometimes wrong and sometimes right, and not just kind of, yeah, like representatives of stories that I guess we've already heard a lot. I think there's a lot of space in like regional stories to have representation of Indigenous people and also just of regional spaces. But yeah, I think that's kind of what I'm trying to focus on now, is having Indigenous characters who aren't like, or trying to create stories where Indigenous characters can be very nuanced and messy and, yeah, who don't represent this idea that we see so much in the screen.
Mm. The avatar of suffering thing. I mean, we were talking about that earlier. But the thing that Australian TV drama, you know, we're seeing more and more Indigenous characters in these stories, which is fantastic. But it's still, it is almost always the case, I think, that that character, the Indigenous character, where they show up is principally there to show how hard it is to be an Indigenous person in contemporary Australia. You know, that's what they sit around talking about.
In non-Indigenous stories, for sure. I mean, there's, of course, incredible Indigenous writers that are doing very nuanced perceptions of Aboriginal people. But yeah, I think definitely that's a big problem in non-Indigenous stories, where there's kind of just, you know, like Australia, where the Indigenous people just serve to be a mirror of white society. But I think that's exactly what happens in the real world as well. Like, that's exactly what I've been talking about as well with like testimonies. Like, Indigenous people are used, I suppose, by respective governments to say, we are, you know, we're making progress and we're doing this. And it's, yeah, I think disrupting that is really important. And when you said avatar, it made me actually remember I was reading this thing that, I don't know if you were using avatar in this sense, but it made me think of the movie Avatar.
Right.
Which is, of course, all about like the destruction of Indigenous land. And apparently there was this phenomenon like after Avatar came out where a lot of people went into like a depression, and they were like, I don't want to keep going on because like this is so messed up what we've done to Indigenous people, which I just think was really interesting that that was like a phenomenon. But it does kind of speak to, yeah, I guess what we're talking about, that colonization is something that has not been beneficial for anyone, I don't think. Like, of course, it's benefited a lot of white people, but I mean, as a fundamental way of thinking about the world, I think everyone suffers as a result of this extractive, short-term way of thinking and being in the world. So I think once we start to see colonization as something that, and colonial thought systems and, you know, capitalism, as things that are not good for anyone and not just an Indigenous issue that Indigenous people have to deal with, that's when we might start to see real change.
Bronte Gosper, Wiradjuri woman from Orange in New South Wales. She recently got her Master's in Oral History from Columbia University in New York. She's now working on her Master's in Dramatic Writing at NIDA in Sydney. She's a researcher with the show Living Black on NITV. She's a documentary maker. She's a screenwriter. She's very, very busy. More info about Bronte Gosper at the Philosopher's Zone website, and you can also find us via ABC Listen, where you can stream or download this and past Philosopher's Zone episodes. The program was produced on Bundjalung Country by me, David Rutledge, and it's been great to have you along this week. See you next time.